I have the great pleasure of introducing Judge Shirley M. Hufstedler, United States Circuit Judge, and I'm going to give you some background information on her. She is married to Seth M. Hufstedler, and they have one son named Stephen. Her husband is a partner in the firm of Beardsley, Hufstedler, and Kimball, and is a past president of the State Bar of California and a former president of the Los Angeles County Bar Association. I'd like to give you some information on her legal background. She was associated with the firm Beardsley, Hufstedler, and Kimball, 1950 through 60, special legal consultant to the Attorney General of California, Colorado River litigation, 1960 through 61. She was appointed judge of the Superior Court, County of Los Angeles, State of California, in 61. Elected judge of the Superior Court in 1962, serves as judge of the Superior Court, appointed associate judge in California Court of Appeal in December of 66, appointed circuit judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, September 12, 1968, assumed office as United States Circuit Judge October 1, 68. She has many, many honors, too many to mention, but a whole list of them. She has written many books, and a lot of them, but I thought one was very interesting that you might want to know the name of it, and it says, New Blocks for Old Pyramids, Reshaping the Judicial System. And I think I'm going to get that one myself and read that. New Blocks for Old Pyramids, Reshaping the Judicial System. And there are many others here. She also, in the area of teaching, has been a member of the faculty, the Appellate Judges Seminar, Institute of Judicial Administration, chairwoman of the law faculty, Salzburg Seminar in American Studies in 1975. For your information, she is the highest ranking woman judge in the United States of America. We are very fortunate to have with us Judge Shirley M. Hufstedler. Won't you join me in welcoming her?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. And for those veterans of not what have been wars, but the survival of a great deal of learning experience in Houston, I'm appreciative that there are enough hardy survivors to be with us this afternoon. Justice is a blindfolded woman. I refer, of course, to the familiar figure of Justice. Like many other noted or indeed notorious ladies, she has a past. In some respects, it's a dark past. We know that she's older than she would like to admit, even to her best friends. She was known in ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome. To Ovid, she was Astrea, the daughter of Jupiter, who ascended to the heavens to become a part of Virgo. In Rome, she sat literally. She was there portrayed headless, seated on a stone, holding scales in one hand and a sword in the other. She rose perhaps for a 7th century stretch, and she's been standing ever since. After she regained her feet and her head, she was depicted either blind or, optically speaking, rather dazzling, with her eyes flashing flames. The blindfold was a modish addition in about 1540, or maybe it was a fire prevention device. Anyway, for more than 400 years, she has been standing dressed in her Grecian gown, tirelessly upholding her scales and clutching her sword. Retrospectively, it's curious that men saw women, saw justice as a woman, because women saw justice not at all or only very dimly for many centuries. As you're well aware, the indictment of the legal status of women, written at the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, was irrefutable. Until the end of the 19th century, all doors to opportunity for women were firmly closed. And as you're also aware, the status of married women was considerably worse than her single sisters. Upon marriage, the husband's and wife's personalities merged and the wife disappeared. We are reminded at this meeting that the women's rights movement did not begin yesterday afternoon. It began to surface at least as early as 1840, and even in 1830, there were stirrings in that direction. What sometimes is forgotten is that the movement was launched on a rather heady mixture of abolition and booze. Leaders of the suffrage movement made a very considered tactical choice. in teaming up with abolitionists and prohibitionists. The suffragettes gained a great deal of support from both, but the joining in tandem with prohibitionists ultimately proved to be a serious barrier in the enactment of suffrage for women. The idea that all those militant teetotalers would get the vote gave the very powerful liquor interest the severe case of the vapors. Despite all of the setbacks, dedicated, indefatigable women carried the cause for suffrage. The enactment of the suffrage amendment in 1920 was a tremendous triumph, not only for women, but also for the country. The suffragettes had hoped that women would vote as a bloc, and that the old walls of discrimination would come tumbling down as the women trumpeted their new political power. The anti-suffrage forces were terrified that they were right. They were both wrong. Women voters, like men voters, were liberal, conservative, independent, and no opinion. In fact, it was business as usual in 1921, just as it had been in 1919. But the fact of the triumph is nevertheless a real one, because we could not have endured indefinitely as a nation half enfranchised and half disenfranchised any more than the nation could long have endured half slave and half free. But when the 18th Amendment was enacted, the Prohibition Amendment, the steam behind the women's movement was very significantly dissipated. Not only had the great causes with the enactment of the suffrage amendment been achieved, but the nation thereafter was engulfed by overwhelming events that eclipsed women's causes. The first was the Great Depression, and the second was the Second World War. It was therefore not until the 1950s, after a glutting diet of homeside togetherness, that the somnolent women's movement began to stir. Each of you will recall the dramatic events in the South which revealed to the nation the festering and flagrant injustices that were being inflicted on black Americans. The discovery of injustice to black Americans aroused some non-black women to observe that invidious discrimination was not confined to black Americans, but extended to women of every color. Young women joined the civil rights movement, marched in demonstrations, and came to know firsthand the indignities to which civil rights workers were subjected. Like the long-forgotten predecessors, the abolitionists and the suffragettes, these women with a cause learned how to organize, petition, demonstrate, fight, and go to jail. One of the outcroppings of the civil rights movement in the 60s was to encourage women to go to law school. Before the 1960s, few law schools failed to admit women. The absence of women from law schools was primarily a response to tremendous social pressures to keep middle-class women out of the workforce and to maintain the legal profession as a predominantly masculine preserve. Women shunned law school as unfeminine. The big turnaround did not occur, however, until the 1970s, when the thin stream of women applying to law schools burgeoned into what are now considered to be floods. I mention this brief bit of history because it has a significant bearing upon the otherwise startling fact that so very few women are on the bench today, especially the federal bench, and upon the extraordinary growth of both legislation and litigation affecting women. Of the 399 authorized active federal district judgeships, only five are held by women. Judge Matthews of the Federal District Court of the District of Columbia, appointed in 1950. Judge Motley of the District Court in New York, appointed in 1966. Judge Kennedy, who has been with us here at the convention, of the District Court in Michigan, appointed in 1970. Judge Green, appointed in 1968 to the District of Columbia District Court, and Judge Ritchie of the District Court of Arizona, appointed in 1976. Judge Hughes of the Texas District Court, also with us here, was appointed in 1961. She is now a senior judge, indicating her semi-retired status. Since my appointment in 1968, I'm still the only woman among the 97 unretired federal circuit judges in the United States. One other woman in the history of the United States was privileged to sit on a federal appellate court. She was Florence Allen, who was appointed by President Roosevelt to the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in 1934. Judge Allen retired in 1959, and she died a few years later. Nobody needs to tell any of you that no woman has ever served on the Supreme Court of the United States. I hope you'll excuse me. I have a very heavy cold, so if I cough and sneeze a bit, you'll understand. The picture is somewhat brighter in respect of women's service on lower echelons of the federal courts as federal magistrates and federal bankruptcy judges. I do not have the updated figures, but a significant number of women now serve in these capacities. In addition, there is one extremely able judge on the United States Tax Court, Judge Hall. Women were almost as rare in state court systems as in the federal system until relatively recently. Fortunately, a substantial number of women now serve at every level in the state judiciaries, including state courts of last resort. Despite the increasing number of women on the bench, the number of women judges is still very small in comparison with men and even with the number of women who practice law today. In state courts, the figure is very slightly over 2%. In the federal courts, it is 1%, or a fraction of 1%. As I've indicated, significant prejudice played a major role in the non-existence of women beyond these numbers in both federal and state court systems. But the real villain of the piece is not so much the most recent history as in recent past history. The problem is that women did not go to law school in very significant numbers until very recently. Persons appointed to the federal district court have sometimes had as little as 10 years of law practice before appointment. But usually a person has been very active in the legal profession for not less than 15 and often as many as 20 years before appointment. And it is even rarer for anyone to be appointed to a federal appellate court with less than 15 years in the legal profession. This situation obviously has elements of some good news and bad news. The bad news is that the number of women qualified for service on the federal bench today is still relatively small. Again, the problem is trying to find women who entered law school, graduated from law school, and went into practice, and who not only went into practice, but who were given enough responsibility in the law offices of which they entered to permit them to surface and make distinguished reputations of at least a decade. However, I must add that the good news is that there are women who have already succeeded in making that course, and even better news, within the reasonably foreseeable future, there will be a great many more. But that fact should be borne in mind when we recognize that we are going to have the most significant increase in federal judgeships in the modern history of the United States, with the creation of well over 100 new United States district courtships. I can't give you the precise number because the precise number is still under negotiation in Congress. And that is also true with respect to United States circuit judgeships. It therefore behooves women who are genuinely concerned about the status of women to exercise what influence they have to gather the lists of those women who are genuinely qualified for these high offices. I cannot emphasize too strongly that it is an extreme disservice to seek out people simply because they are women. Nothing reinforces sexual stereotypes or racial stereotypes at a swifter pace than to press somebody who is significantly unqualified for the job, so that it must be done meticulously and carefully, because I know, and you know, if you're in the legal profession or associated with those who are in your own groups, that there are women of just this kind of quality and distinction who are out there. And it is necessary to obtain the dossiers upon these women and bring them to the attention of the various appointing bodies. We simply cannot let presidents, senators, governors, and other appointing powers fail to be regularly admonished, as did the redoubtable Abigail Adams, remember the ladies. And I don't mean by sending them a Mother's Day card. I now turn to a brief discussion about what federal courts do, particularly appellate courts, which I hope will help those of you who are not thoroughly familiar with court systems to become acquainted with the jobs that I and my sisters of the appellate and trial benches do. And I must ask the endurance of those who are thoroughly familiar with these processes to bear with me as I work through my little primer course. The United States Supreme Court is an institution known to all Americans, yet few people outside the legal profession and students of government have a very clear idea of what the United States Supreme Court does or how that court performs its functions. And in contrast, even the existence of the United States Courts of Appeals and the impact upon all phases of American life by the work of these courts is all well known. We are obscure subjects as far as most Americans are concerned. Despite their anonymity, the United States Courts of Appeals hand down decisions literally daily, which profoundly affect the quality of life in the United States and the rights and duties of us all. The United States Courts of Appeals are the courts of last resort in 99% of the litigation conducted in the federal courts and in the federal administrative agencies. The Supreme Court of the United States reviews presently less than 1% of the decisions made by the United States Courts of Appeals. You will understand why that is so when I tell you that the average number of cases to which the United States Supreme Court gives plenary consideration per year, i.e. per Supreme Court term, is approximately 150, which includes the reviewing power of all of 50 state courts of last resort on federal questions, together with all of the decisions made by the United States Courts of Appeals. The relative obscurity of the United States Courts of Appeals is primarily attributable to the fact that neither our formal nor our informal educational processes have taught laymen anything about the structure of judicial systems in the United States, and indeed taught nothing about the work of each level of courts within the judicial systems. First step to understanding is a primer course in judicial structure. I think you're aware that in the United States we have two completely different systems of courts operating at the same time, the federal system and the state system, just as we have both federal and state governments operating simultaneously. Some kinds of cases can be tried only in the federal courts, some only in the state courts, and a few kinds can be tried in either one. The problems of federal jurisdiction are extremely complicated, but I can say in a general way that federal courts hear cases involving federal questions, such as federal constitutional questions, and cases involving federal statutes. In a limited set of situations, federal courts do apply state law as well. Within each system, federal and state, there are at least two layers, and oftentimes more than two layers, of courts, trial and appellate. Trial and appellate courts serve very different functions, and they operate in very different ways. Most people know quite a lot about trial courts because they have served on jury, or if they have not, they have seen countless representations of trial courts on television and in the movies. The pictures of trial courts thus presented is distorted and oftentimes entirely inaccurate, but at least some of the workings of trial courts are shown. Trial courts, sitting with or without juries, hear testimony, receive exhibits, decide which ones are telling the truth and which ones aren't, and in criminal cases, trial courts decide guilt or innocence. Appellate courts are not the subject of films, and very few books are written about them for non-lawyers. All appellate courts, including the United States Supreme Court, are open to the public, but very little of what can be seen in an appellate courtroom means a great deal to a non-lawyer. Appellate courts do not hear testimony. There are no juries. Appellate courts do not decide factual questions at all. In criminal cases, appellate courts do not decide guilt or innocence. Indeed, appellate courts, with trivial exceptions, never hear any cases involving innocent criminals. Once a criminal defendant has been acquitted, the government cannot appeal. The business of appellate courts is confined to deciding questions of law. Trial judges sit one at a time, with very rare exceptions. Appellate judges never sit one at a time. All appellate courts are multiple judge courts, each judge sitting on each case with at least two of his or her colleagues. In the United States Supreme Court, and in almost all state courts of last resort, all members of the court sit together to hear the appeal in every case. We call that sitting en banc. Unless, of course, an individual justice is for some reason personally disqualified or happens to be ill. In the United States Courts of Appeals, and in almost all intermediate state appellate court systems, the judges sit in panels of not less than three. On occasions, United States Courts of Appeals sit en banc for the purpose, for instance, of overruling a prior decision of that court. No decision can be reached in any appellate case until a majority of the judges sitting on the case agree how the case will come out, or in the case of an evenly divided court, where for some reason the odd number involved in the court cannot be reached because a particular justice, for instance, is disqualified. In which case, for example, if the United States Supreme Court divides 4-4, the result is an affirmance by default, so to speak, of what happened below. And that since there is no majority opinion, all one really has is a weather vane for a future case. Aside from occasional ceremonial appearances, the only time appellate judges ever sit in the courtroom is to hear oral argument upon the legal questions presented by the lawyers. Before oral argument, the judges have read a written record of what happened at the trial and have also read written arguments on questions of law presented by the lawyers. Almost all the time of an appellate judge is spent off the bench, studying the records and arguments and writing decisions. Decisions take the form of written opinions, which recite the facts of the case, state the legal questions that must be decided, discuss the merits of the legal issues, and finally decide those questions, and issue directions for the disposition of a controversy. The decisions take the form of written opinions or orders. All the orders and opinions of the United States Supreme Court are not only written, but they are published. A vast number of the opinions of the United States Courts of Appeals are published, but these days many are not published when the opinions are not deemed by the court to be useful in deciding future cases. Trial courts decide only the very case before them, because trial court decisions on questions of fact and questions of law do not affect the outcome of any other case. Appellate court opinions decide not only the very case before them, but also other cases. The rules of law stated in an appellate opinion bind not only the litigants in that case, but decide in advance all later cases in the same judicial system, which raise the same legal questions. This is the principle which we know under that marvelous Latinism, stare decisis. It is this rule that makes appellate opinions important. Stare decisis, coupled with the Federal Supremacy Clause, makes the decisions of the United States Supreme Court the enormously important matters they are. All of the courts in the United States must follow the rules of the federal and constitutional law laid down by the Supreme Court of the United States. The point to remember is that each published appellate opinion lays down rules that must be applied not only to the decided case, but to all other cases in the same judicial system that raise the same legal questions. There are relatively few ways to overturn an appellate decision on a point of law. If the point of law involves a statutory question, the legislature that enacted the law can avoid the court decision by amending or otherwise altering or repealing the statute or the judicial decision. A higher appellate court can overturn a lower appellate court. Thus, only the Supreme Court of the United States can overturn a decision by a United States Court of Appeals on a question of federal law, because it is the only court in the United States that is higher than the Supreme Court. Unless and until a decision on a question of federal constitutional law is overturned by the Supreme Court or by an amendment of the United States Constitution, the decisions of the United States Courts of Appeals on constitutional issues are binding. When the Supreme Court of the United States decides a constitutional question, only the United States Supreme Court or an amendment to the federal Constitution can overturn it. As compared to state judicial systems with over 10,000 judges, the federal system is very small. As you know, there are 9 members of the Supreme Court of the United States. At the present time, there are 97 active judgeships of the United States Courts of Appeal. We are hoping to have a significant expansion of that number. But until that expansion occurs, there are now and have always been significantly fewer United States circuit judges than there are senators. And as a matter of protocol for anybody who's interested, United States circuit judges rank with United States senators. In addition to the active judges of the federal courts, we have the benefit of the services of our retired circuit judges who sit with us as much as their health and their inclinations permit. There are now, as I mentioned earlier, 399 active federal district judges. Federal district judges are the trial judges. To be sure, we now have federal magistrates and federal bankruptcy judges who are not constitutional Article III judges, who try a great many kinds of things, but they are not able to try everything that federal district judges try. The number of judges in state systems, of course, runs into all of those thousands because we have 50 states with 50 separate state judicial systems. Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States and of the United States Courts of Appeal and federal district judges are called Article III judges after Article III of the federal Constitution. All of us are appointed by the President of the United States with the advice and consent of the Senate for life, subject to good behavior. At the present time, the only way to remove these federal judges under Article III of the Constitution is by way of impeachment. The purpose of lifetime tenure is to assure that the federal judiciary will be a truly independent branch of government. Framers of the federal Constitution wanted to insulate federal judges from pressures imposed by the elective process to prevent them from yielding or being forced to yield to majoritarian pressures when courts make decisions in favor of minority views which are unpopular with a then current majority. The decision of Brown versus Board of Education, which all of you know compelled racial integration of the public schools, is an illustration of just such a decision. Appellate courts serve two very different functions. First, appellate courts review the trial record for error in a particular case. We call that the review for correctness. Second, appellate courts use the cases before them as vehicles for stating and applying constitutional principles, for authoritatively interpreting statutes, for formulating and expressing policies on legal issues of system-wide concern, for developing the common law, and for supervising each level of the judicial system below them. We call the second set of functions the institutional functions. With each rise in the appellate structure, the importance of the review for correctness diminishes, and the importance of the institutional functions increase. For instance, by the time discretionary review has been granted by the United States Supreme Court, the corrective function has been almost totally eclipsed by the institutional function. For this reason, the individual litigant is almost incidental in many appellate opinions, particularly those from the Supreme Court of the United States. The function of the Supreme Court is not to decide the fate of any one person or to decide any single controversy. The vehicle for performing that function is always a real case because the court cannot speak in any other context. But the Supreme Court neither accepts nor rejects cases on the merits of the particular litigants. Rather, the cases are accepted because they present legal questions which need to be answered authoritatively for the entire country. The smallest in terms of its turf is the District of Columbia Circuit, whose geographical territory is restricted to the district. But be assured that that territory has immensely significant problems because it also has primary responsibility for a whole alphabet soup of extremely important federal administrative agencies. My court presently has 13 active judges. I might say active is a term of art. We do not have any inert judges.